Toll, dass ihr dabei seid bei der aktuellen Folge dieses Interview-Podcasts Advantage. Hier bekommt ihr kostenlos die erste Hälfte des Gesprächs der neuen Folge. Das Gespräch endet nach der Hälfte des Interviews und das gesamte Interview, das gibt's exklusiv auf der Patreon-Seite dieses Podcasts unter www.patreon.com/advantagepodcast. Und jetzt viel Spaß beim Hören. Folge 22.
Ja, moin aus Hamburg and welcome to episode 22, the second one in English. As you know, we have now monthly interviews with international colleagues of mine that covers tennis as a journalist. Like recently, 1 month ago, was the first international interview with Sasha Osmo from Serbian about Djokovic and the reception of tennis in Serbia. Thanks again for hearing and watching this episode, and thanks to Sasha again. Today is a new episode 22, as I told you, today with the tennis correspondent of the English Telegraph, the newspaper, one of the biggest in the UK, was former a cricket correspondent, now focused since a decade on tennis, is also the vice chairman of the Lawn Tennis Writers Association, very experienced with a lot of context. Hello, Simon Briggs.
Hi, you missed out my former career as a rock critic.
Good that you mentioned it, because my regular listeners here, they know I start the interview always with a bit of a tricky, not as serious questions. And as I know you well as a good colleague, I appreciate your help. I'm a very young journalist and you took care of mine, and the listeners and our readers know we also published pieces together, mainly about doping. But thanks for this in first place. But my first question is about rock music, because I know that you're very much into rock music, and also not only in your job earlier, but also as a private person. I want to know you, what's your favorite music album, actually, or in the past, as you want to?
Probably classic 1970s stuff, Led Zeppelin. In my opinion, the greatest album ever recorded is Exile on Main Street by the Rolling Stones. I do have one story I should tell. When I was a rock journalist in the 90s, there was something here called Britpop. We had Oasis and Blur. They were the two big bands in the 90s.
Well known also in Germany.
Yeah. And at that time, Boris Johnson, who is now the Prime Minister, currently locked in the last stages of Brexit negotiations, he was a columnist on my newspaper.
No way.
And he rang me up one day because he wanted to talk to me about Oasis and Blur. And he said, Simon, I just didn't think that they have any decent tunes. I think he was talking about Oasis specifically, and I said, "Well, I think they, you know, the tunes are okay. So they're not very original." And he said, "I don't believe you. I bet you can't remember the tune of Wonderwall." And I said, "Oh, I can." He said, "Well, if you can, then sing it to me," which was quite embarrassing because at the time I was actually at work in the cricket magazine where I worked during the day, and I would do the rock reviews at night.
I understand.
All right. With my puzzles and cricket colleagues around me, I tried to warble down the phone to Boris Johnson. I think maybe he just wanted to embarrass me anyway, but it didn't make any difference because he still wrote the same piece he was going to write anyway about how they all sounded the same and didn't have any decent tunes. That was my highlight of my rock writing career.
Unbelievable. Do you have still contact to the Prime Minister? No.
No. I mean, he was a journalist. This is one of the problems that we have in the UK, that we are run by a couple of journalists in Boris Johnson and a second person, probably the second most important person in the Conservative Party, Michael Gove. I mean, he at least was a news reporter, so he was a little less flaky than Boris, who was a columnist. But, you know, it's as if we are governed by essay crisis, because they're constantly, you know, bumping up against every deadline because they're journalists. You know, that's what we do.
Unbelievable story to the start of this episode. We are a tennis podcast, so we will mainly talk about tennis, but this was a very good start. As with every guest, I will announce the social accounts of Simon Briggs. You can find him mainly on Twitter, at Simon Briggs, Simon, S-I-M-O-N-B-R-E-G-G-S.
No. Though you're missing the R. There was already a Simon Briggs, so it has to be at Simon R for Robert Briggs. From the middle initial.
Perfect. But you will find him, I guess, because he has more than 11,000 followers, not only into the tennis bubble, very famous and very good journalist. I also have social accounts. You can find this podcast mainly at Instagram. Advantage podcast and on Twitter Advantage POD. And you know, you can support this podcast on Patreon. We have 35 supporters. You can support the podcast with €5 each month and get a new episode every week and special episodes like this in English one time each month. You can get for €1 a month. Thank you for your support. We want to talk about your life as a journalist, obviously. We want also to talk later on a bit about the lawsuit between German player Alexander Zverev and his former manager, which apparently started today in London. And we want to talk a bit about the balance in tennis journalism between normal journalism and, yeah, a bit more deeper topics and the problems that British tennis has got in 2020. Simon, as you know me, I did my research. I find a YouTube video from Wimbledon 2018 where you were interviewed a bit, I think, with a guy from the Canada Federation. I didn't know if this is correct, but in this interview you mentioned that your first Wimbledon as a fan, not as a journalist, was probably 1992. Do you remember still what you said 2 years ago?
Well, yeah, I remember the match anyway. I'm not sure I've ever looked it up, but it was Forger against Courier on the old court too, I think. I mean, the whole of Wimbledon has been rebuilt since I came then. I wasn't a regular tennis visitor. I was more of a cricket man in those days. I remember being on the top of the next door court and looking over the top to watch Forger beating Courier in what was a brilliant match. And Forger was a really elegant serve volleyer. And Courier, as you remember, was more of a sort of Neanderthal. You know, he kind of smacked it. It's a somewhat ugly backhand, but you know, pretty intense player, and so different. You know, now I sort of see him as a commentator with almost a kind of a thespian delivery and a fantastic vocabulary and a really cerebral guy. And it's so different to the image that you present with that baseball cap down over his head, sort of, you know, with his big shoulders and his kind of grunting.
Yeah, totally agree. It's funny how different it is sometimes between your style of tennis and your acting in life. Some player are very similar to that, and some people are quite different. When you say you were more into cricket back then as a young man, what was your access to tennis, and how did you land it up in Wimbledon?
Well, I kind of got sacked from cricket, really, for being a bit rubbish at news reporting. I mean, the paper didn't get rid of me, but they put me in a floating role for a year. And then they gave they gave the cricket job I was in to somebody who was a bit better on the ground getting stories. I was more of a scribbler in those days, didn't get many stories, had come up alongside old-fashioned reporters who were really just ex-players or funny writers, not people who were actually digging for real information on the ground. And I was very weak at that. So it was only after I got moved sideways that I began to look at what the person who replaced me was doing and began to learn a bit about how you did that. And now, you know, I take that side of the job very seriously, and it's sort of satisfying because I couldn't do it for years and years. And now I think, you know, I can get a few stories most years, there's no feeling, I guess, in this business quite as good as getting a decent story. You can write a piece that you're proud of, but it's not as exciting as when you actually have information you can break for the first time.
Understand. You're actually from Oxford, and I imagine you studied in Cambridge history. So is this allowed? Because if you think as a German, Oxford and Cambridge with all the rivalries, was it a bit difficult to study there as a native Oxford guy, or how can I imagine that as a German guy?
Well, the point was really I could have probably applied to either, but I didn't want to stay in the same city for another 3 years. My parents both worked at Oxford University anyway, which, you know, that wasn't the problem. I just wanted a change of scene, it was definitely my sort of moment of becoming independent, and then the best 3 years probably of my life, and met a lot of friends who I still have to this day. So it was probably the right decision.
But you weren't rowing, were you?
I did row for one term. We entered the novice race for people in their first term, and there were 73 boats entered, and we came 72nd, and the 73rd boat sank.
That's actually quite good.
Well, it's better than coming 51st, I always say. It's a bit more memorable than coming 51st.
Okay, then we save 51. We lock in 51. You studied history, I mentioned. When did you decide to be a journalist? You mentioned you did music, you did cricket. What was the development of this all? When did you know I want to be a good journalist?
Well, I didn't really make an early step. I didn't do much at university. I went to the university newspaper and found them all a bit dauntingly cool. They were all too cool for me. I was too much of a nerd. Mm-hmm. I didn't really feel like I fitted in, so I didn't really hang around there. I was enjoying myself too much to kind of do something that made me uncomfortable at the time. So I kind of gave that up until I left, and then I managed to get a couple of work experience weeks. And then I managed to get a placement on this magazine, and eventually they employed me. And I went from the Telegraph doing rock reviews as a freelance to being on the sports desk as a salaried employee. And then I've been there for 20 years. So the only paper I've ever really written for, with a couple of tiny exceptions, is the Telegraph ever since 1996.
And then, yeah, but as I mentioned in the start of the episode, one of the biggest newspapers in the UK. Now you're in it for, you told me, for 20 years with a lot of experience. In your opinion, what is important if you want to be a journalist in sports in the UK?
Well, I mean, it's there's two parts to it, isn't there? There's the digging around for the information and the writing. So as I say, I was good at the second when I started, and not so good at the first, and I've had to learn that. Most people tend to do one or the other, and it's to do with your character, I guess, and your background. Sport is just a kind of slightly weird part of the business to be in. You know, tennis doesn't have many reporting jobs anywhere, I don't think, because it's not the biggest sport in any one country. In France, maybe the only place where they have maybe quite a few tennis writers, but even then, not that many. It's a niche sport. So if you want to become a tennis writer, you probably need to be a football writer or a cricket writer in the UK, or, you know, do something else first. If you're in the States, do NFL or whatever, because those are big sports. And then, you know, once you've got a reputation, maybe you can find a way into tennis, because it's a small field.
Mm. But you have a high percentage of tennis pieces into your work, haven't you?
Yeah, I mean, that's my day job. But I mean, there's only three papers over here who have tennis writers who really travel on the tour. Mm. There's only three of us who really travel on the tour. You know, there's a bunch of people who go to the slams. But if you're talking about outside the slams, it's only me, then Mike Dixon from the Daily Mail, Stu Fraser from the Times, and, you know, that's most of it. Has been for the last few years.
Understand. For you, maybe it's a bit low, but my feeling when I was at Wimbledon for the first time 3 years ago, I immediately noticed that sports reporting in Great Britain, especially newspapers, are perceived very highly in the UK and are treated better than in other countries, or maybe also better than here in Germany. Do you agree with that? And if yes, why do you think it is like that?
Well, I don't really have enough experience of Europe to know, but I mean, look, the England sees itself as the birthplace of sport, and you know, with good reason, because England codified most of these sports. We have an incredibly big appetite for sport. When the Olympics came here in 2012, every session was full. And not only that, but every Paralympic session was full. I mean, there are very few other countries that would be able to stage an Olympics and fill up all those sessions. Mm-hmm. It just shows that what a big part of our culture it is. And writing about sport is also a big cultural aspect of British newspapers. And, you know, a newspaper in this country, if you could go back to cricket, will run 4 or 5 pages of cricket on a single day. And that's the sport which, even here, has a somewhat exclusive social kind of niche. And a lot of people don't follow it at all. But it just is part of our culture. That's the only thing I can say, I guess. And in terms of Wimbledon, it's a huge cultural phenomenon because it's on all day on BBC One, the biggest free-to-air broadcaster. And people watch it who don't watch sport the rest of the year. So there's a phrase in this country that is, tennis in Britain is not a sport, it's a fortnight. And that is very true. And then during Wimbledon, tennis is on the front pages and the back pages every day. And you really feel like you're at the center of the universe. But then, you know, in October, let's say, or in February, you do sometimes find yourself wondering, what the hell am I doing this for? Nobody gives a flying stuff. And it's a massive difference between those two extremes, depending on what point of the year you're at.
I understand. But on the one hand, I'm always hyped if you show me how many pages in sports in general you have on the next day. And on the other hand, I'm also hyped when you tell me that, with the, how is it called in English, with the behind the paywalls, stuff you tried at the Telegraph. You told me that it's financed by the readers very well, and that's not the average system. Many media struggle with it, also in Germany. I can tell you. So I appreciate it a lot how it can work, and it's a good sign for journalism in the digital world. That's my opinion. So
Well, lockdown has been beneficial for, I think, a lot of papers with paywalls, because people have been looking for something to read while they haven't been able to do anything, and they're obviously following a very fast-moving news agenda. So this year has been tough in a lot of ways, but actually I think paywall newspapers have done okay out of this year.
I understand. But anyway, you managed to get through your way to be a good journalist at the big newspaper now for years. And we want to come to tennis, to a special topic. As I mentioned earlier, we are recording on Monday. So if you listen to this later in the week, just that you know, today on Monday, the lawsuit between Alexander Zverev, the number one German player, and his former manager from Chile, Patricio Pai, started today.
Are you sure about that?
That it started today?
Yeah, I think it may start on Thursday.
Oh, all right. Then maybe the Spiegel was wrong, because actually I quoted now a piece from the Spiegel that was published last week. It was a long story. We talked about it privately. It was published last week, and they wrote that it starts today. But okay, let's say
it starts this week.
Yeah. Perfect. Thank you for this information, because you're also very well informed. That's why I want to ask you to bring everyone on the same level, what it's all about. Sasha Zverev, meanwhile, is at Team 8 at the management agency where Roger Federer is involved very much. he resigned his contract 23 months ago with Patricio Appice. His first contract was when he was 15 years old, back in 2012. And they worked together very professionally and successfully. But later on, he was not happy with it anymore. And now in 2020, the family says that the contract that was negotiated back then in 2012 was not understandable 100% for the family back then, with language issues and all the stuff. And the contract runs until at least 2023 with 5 more years commission for Patricio Appice, and the British lawyer of the Zverev family says this is illegal and they want to fight against it in this lawsuit. The first contract, maybe just this is another information, the first contract, according to the Spiegel page, was that Patricio Appice got the family 60,000 euros over 4 years with a payback option so that they can bring the tennis life for Sasha Zverev alive and can develop this. This short information before we talk about it. Simon, I know that you're well informed, have a lot of contacts also to agents and stuff like this. What is your perception from this difficult topic in general?
Well, I mean, it's a big case for the whole world of sports agents, because if you sign a contract, as Zverev did, that runs from 2018 to 2023, and then you leave without really showing any kind of malfeasance or bad conduct on the part of the agent that you've signed with, then if you can do that without having to pay any compensation, that would make a lot of agents very nervous. So everyone's watching pretty closely. You know, the case is the burden is being borne, let's say, by Zverev's parents. They're the ones who seem to be bringing the case. It's like, it seems to me that Team 8, who are representing him at the moment, don't really want to get involved any more than they have to. Zverev himself, the same goes for him. So Mama and Papa end up being the ones who seem to be bringing the action, from what I've seen from Der Spiegel. They can claim that they were, let's say, hoodwinked when Zverev was 15 years old. But then it doesn't quite explain why they re-signed when he was 19 for 5 years. So I think it puts them in a difficult position. They have a lot of work to do to prove that they have a justification in breaking the contract. It'd be interesting to see how the case unfolds. But clearly, Alexander Zverev has managed to find himself in a lot of off-court difficulties in the last 2 years. We have now the case involving Olga Sharapova, his former girlfriend, accusing him of domestic abuse, which was a big factor in the end of this season and will continue to be a factor, I think, going into 2021, I should say. And it'll be interesting when Roger Federer next goes to a tournament to see how that affects him, because he is one of the founders of Team 8 management. So I'm not sure how happy he will be if it tarnishes his super clean image by association. So Zverev, when he broke off the contract with Appe at the beginning of 2019, you know, it seemed to coincide with a loss of form. I did an interview with him last summer at Wimbledon, where he said that it had been very difficult for him. He'd been doing all these different roles for himself, and he hadn't been used to organizing things, speaking to sponsors about deals himself directly. I mean, he certainly made it sound like it was a major headache. And as I say, his results did seem to be effective for a while. He obviously won the ATP finals at the end of 2018, and he hasn't had quite such a high point since, although you could argue that he did do very well in the US Open this year when he reached the final. So that perhaps will give him encouragement that he can get through and continue to move his way towards being the all-time great that he wants to be.
Yes. Obviously, we are reporting about this topic over a long period of time. Back then, when it started in, I remember, March 2019, when Sasha Zverev went public that he will go on court against Appai. He told me it was luck for me that I was like the source of the start of this whole topic. March, it was also the start of our relationship as journalists, I remember. And I remember when we were talking about it that there were rumors that he will join Team 8, which he did now, as we all know, that it could be that, I don't know, Roger Federer and or Team 8, they will pay a big amount of money to level up everything and to bring an end to this issue, or even on a lawsuit they will pay something. And now you're saying, I think that Team 8 will be not involved very much. So do you think it will go all the way without Team 8 involved in any time in this lawsuit?
I don't know for sure, but I just think that the family are trying to make the case. You know, it's them who are saying that they had this contract in when he was 15 that was misleading or incomplete, or they felt that they had been taken advantage of. I don't think they have a strong case from what I've seen yet, but maybe there are things yet to come out. I mean, on the face of it, Patricio Appai took a decision to support a very good junior by funding him. That's the risk that he took when he invested 60,000 euros. And then he represented Zverev, and they seemed to be being successful together. And I sort of feel like it was more of a personal fallout that triggered the situation than any real professional failing on Appai's part. I think it was a personal fallout. And you know, as I say, Zverev has shown himself so far in his career that there's now been two quite big off-court issues that have arisen for him. On top of that, he's had a tough year, hasn't he, with the COVID stuff. He got
you can tell
a couple of times the way he handled it. And he just seems like a rather naive young man in a lot of ways. He would have been insulated from the real world, like a lot of tennis players, because of his remarkable talent. And he's been taken care of to a large extent by his parents, who travel almost all the time with him, and his brother, who guided him. And my impression of him is sometimes of a man who hasn't grown up quite yet. And that's not unusual among tennis players. Tennis players are a very, very particular breed, and they're not like the rest of us. I mean, Zverev is a remarkably charismatic man. One of the things I notice about him is when he does the Laver Cup and he goes on stage with his microphone, he completely commands the audience in a way that not even Federer does. Yeah. And that is a unique thing. So he comes across as extremely impressive on a one-to-one level, but I think it's slightly is a charisma that he has that disguises a naivety underneath.
Completely agree. There's no player in the game who has such a difference if he appears on a stage like a big tennis court and he gives a speech there. And on the opposite side, he is somewhere in the press conference room arguing about a very strong question. And there is a huge difference between the style like giving this speech and answering these questions, I sometimes cannot believe how big this difference is, but I hope that he will develop this a bit in the next years.
In press conferences, I find him very quotable a lot of the time. He does address questions. Sometimes he probably addresses questions he shouldn't. And he often gives us a lot to write about, you know, in a way that...
Naivety.
Yeah, possibly. In a way that somebody like maybe Medvedev, you know, Medvedev is quite a good talker, but Zverev, he's quite easy to write about. There's often... I'm just talking as a selfish journalist here. You know, there's some players go through their careers and there's just nothing there to get hold of. Let me give you Marin Cilic, you know, won a major. There was the doping ban he managed to get for one point in his career. But
back in 2013, it was.
There was so little with Marin Cilic to kind of develop a character around. David Ferrer, you know, these are players who you grasp for something to introduce them to your readers and you struggle. Now, Zverev never had that, you know. He had lots going for him. In a bad way, he's now created a lot of storylines and ripples and anxieties around the game. Mm-hmm. But he's eventful. He is a person to whom things happen and who makes things happen. So he talks well most of the time. So as a reporter, he's actually quite good news in a perfectly selfish way for us. But I think he is somebody who falls into manholes when he's not looking.
I understand. To end this topic, Patricio Appé is also well known in Great Britain, as he was the former agent of Andy Murray. What's his perception in Great Britain? How is he seen in the tennis bubble, let's say?
Patricio, he's a well-known agent who's worked with so many people, you know, Gabriella Sabatini, going back a long way. He's had so many clients, some people who've maybe been famous and drifted off the scene, like Malavai Washington, who was a Wimbledon finalist. Andy Murray was a big one, and he was taken out of the picture by a guy called Simon Fuller, who used to manage the Spice Girls, who I used to write rock reviews about. And Simon Fuller came in and gave him he managed David Beckham at the time, and Simon Fuller gave him the full show business pitch and stole Murray away. But I personally sometimes wonder, you know, if that was a good decision, because I think Patricio is a pretty good agent overall, and I, you know, would find him good to deal with.
Okay, let's see what the outcome will be of this lawsuit. Maybe they can agree silently on a payment or something like this, but this payment certainly will be not as small as Alex Zverev maybe will hope for it. But what impressed me most is that in this podcast already the Prime Minister appeared, the Spice Girls appeared, Oasis appeared, David Beckham appeared, and the Verve. So very good, Simon. Your peak level is on fleet. Perfect. You know that I like you very much because I really think that your reporting is very balanced between normal tennis reports, often sport politics pieces, also doping, and yeah, you're writing about what you think is good for your readers, what is actually happen in the sports world, which should be normal but isn't, in my opinion. I want to talk with you about one example you published recently. You already mentioned the problems, the off-court problems Alexander Zverev had with the sexual harassment allegation his ex-girlfriend brought up 2 months ago. You wrote about Milos Raonic, the Canadian former Wimbledon finalist, that he continues to work with his agent, who has also very much off-court problems. He left, I guess, the Federation in the wake of also sexual harassment allegation. Can you bring a bit light into this? What is this all about?
Oh, yeah, that's the story of Amit Naur, who also worked with Andy Murray. In fact, he was put in as Andy Murray's contact man by Simon Fuller to handle day-to-day stuff like sort of exhibition fees and those sorts of things. immediately after Andy Murray left, left Patricio. It was a bizarre moment in 2011 at the Australian Open final when Nao, who, you know, has been a very effective agent in a lot of ways, he was representing both Murray and Djokovic, who then played each other in the final. And I think things weren't going terribly well between Murray and Nao at the time. Then they definitely went downhill after Nao came into the locker room celebrating with Djokovic after the victory, while Murray was sitting at the far end of the room in a kind of dejected state. Which I think that was the end of probably the straw that broke the camel's back in terms of that relationship. So more recently, Nao started working with Raonic in 2011. Then in 2017, he was dismissed by the agency he was working with, Creative Artists Agency, which is a big Hollywood player involved in a lot of showbiz stuff. Mm-hmm. It was after another agent at CAA, who was kind of effectively his assistant, had made allegations of persistent sexual harassment. CAA looked into them at the time and said that they found some of them to be accurate, and he was asked to leave, but at no point did he stop working with Raonic, and he's still very much part of the circuit. And I asked Raonic about this at a Zoom conference before the US Open, and he said that the allegations weren't true in his opinion, and that it's all about people. I think the phrase he used was leaning on cancel culture a little bit too much, mm-hmm. Which I thought was somewhat a trivializing way of addressing what were very serious allegations, which had been investigated by the overarching agency and found to have some merit. And I thought that was a remarkably, I thought that was an irresponsible way of approaching a serious subject to just trivialize it in that manner. So, yeah, I did a thousand words or so on that just after the French Open had finished.
Mm-hmm. In this specific case and this specific report, were you happy with the feedback or what do you think about the feedback after you published it?
Well, certainly there were plenty of people who were already, I think, looking at other issues. I think it had already been the case that Zverev's Sharapova allegations had arisen. A lot of people picked up on it and pointed out, well, that they agree with me, I guess, about the way that Raonic had seemed to rather unthinkingly dismiss the charges and that it didn't look good. But they were all with people on social media. You know, there was no official response. Tennis, you tend not to find that anyone who works in the sport or anyone who has a sort of name in the sport, they tend not to pick up on anything that's at all sensitive in that manner. You can write pieces that, you know, throw a questionable light on organizations, on individuals, and there'll be this deafening silence within the sport. As you have seen with, indeed, with the Sharapova, there are allegations which have only, I think, been pointed out within the sport by a couple of female players, Daria Gavrilova and Nicole Gibbs. So it's a sport which likes to present a pristine exterior, whereas underneath, you know, there's a lot of cans of worms, to use a proverb we like to use in the UK, a lot of cans of worms which can be opened. And the attitude of the sport as a whole tends to be to look away.
But it's a difficult position as a journalist then, isn't it? After what you are telling me. So to bring up these topics and maybe I don't know what's the feedback like in with your colleagues if you publish. You're on the run and you publish a piece like this and then a doping piece, and what's the perception of your colleagues? Are they saying, well, that's great stuff, we want more from this, or are they then maybe saying, okay, Simon, maybe now next week a bit more about backhands or stuff like this?
No, they're definitely not saying the second. I mean, to be honest, they tend not to say anything either. I mean, if you do a story which is quite interesting, like you and I worked on the story about the lack of doping tests this year before the French Open owing to COVID, you know, which is definitely an interesting subject. Again, I mean, you tend not to hear too much because people are looking at it probably thinking that's quite good, you know, but they tend not to come up to you and shake you by the hand because it's just not that kind of a business. Everyone gets on with their own work.
Understand.
But in terms of being worried about it casting a bad light on the sport, no, I mean, that is very much people who work in sports journalism in this country like to think that they're proper journalists. Now, that may not always be the case, but they like to think that they're people who will hold the sport to account, because we do have a very strong tradition of that as being a part of even someone who simply writes kind of colourful accounts of a football match. They will still probably think of themselves as somebody who would like to cast a light on any wrongdoing or scandal. They would never publicly question that as a tactic. You certainly don't get that kind of response in the UK. I think there are certain countries where, you know, the journalism that you see is of a much more sort of pushy and pokey nature. I think we're quite awkward, and sometimes players will come to the UK knowing they're going to be asked about things they might otherwise prefer not to be. It also is true in Australia. You know, when you go into the Australian Open, I think the Australian reporters can often be quite brusque, and they don't shy away from asking difficult questions, and that's just the kind of culture of the media in both countries.
A German colleague who studied in Great Britain, he once told me that British reporters are working together when it comes to press conferences, in terms of if they want to know a certain thing, that they work together and start to ask kindly, and the one reporter asks a bit more friendly, and then the other one overtakes and asks a bit more ongoing and stuff like this. Is it like this, that you're like orchestrating a bit press conferences? Because that's not
sometimes
what we're doing in Germany.
Yeah, sometimes. I mean, I suppose when you're dealing with the Premier League in particular, you're dealing with athletes who are very difficult to get to. And the more that you have a problem in terms of access, the more you can be potentially shy of telling the truth. You can become a client journalist, and that's, you know, that does happen. It does happen here. I mean, I'm sounding ambitious and kind of and talking up the British press, but it definitely can happen over here. You see it sometimes with people who cover one club, particularly. That they would be worried about writing anything that might offend that club, because it would lose them access to the players and the staff who they need to run their daily stories. So that can happen for sure. And I guess, you know, I'm sure that we have maybe gone soft on Murray a few times over the years, because Murray has always been our meal ticket. So even though I'm talking up the British media as being fearless and investigative, perhaps that's more likely to apply to people who aren't our daily bread and butter in terms of being overseas players. Perhaps that's the case.
Yeah, obviously it's difficult if you're a specific writer in a specific sports, and you have to deal with the same players week out, week in. It's difficult. Same for me with Alexander Zverev, for example, and his crucial year 2020. Nevertheless, you have to report about it. You mentioned it already. We did a few doping reports together. For example, this year at the Australian Open, about former coaches with doping problems with former players with doping problems that work now as coaches on the Pro Tour, together with Edmund Willison, our dear colleague, and the other piece you mentioned earlier. I'm freelancing right now, and I can take my time to do the research if something is until something is finished. It's not always good because it takes time, and then I'm not earning much money. But for you, it's more difficult as you have to write on a daily basis. So how do you manage it if you do long researches and pieces that take time, to bring it in your daily work.
Das war der erste frei zugängliche Teil der neuen Folge. Die zweite Hälfte hört ihr exklusiv auf der Patreon-Seite www.patreon.com/advantagepodcast. Dort könnt ihr mit einem kleinen monatlichen Beitrag dafür sorgen, dass es diese langen, unabhängigen Interviews ohne Werbung regelmäßig gibt und unterstützt zudem Yannicks unabhängige Arbeit als freier Journalist im Tennis-Doping- und Sportpolitik-Bereich.